tuned for The Positive Mind coming up.
Hey, everybody. Kev O'Donoghue and Ben Starr back with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you some ideas, concepts, and guests, try and help you lead a more positively minded life. Welcome back. Welcome back from the Fun Drive if you're just joining us and missed us yesterday. Today we have our same guest, but also an additional guest today. We have Dr. Kent Robertshaw back in the studio. Hi, Kent.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, we talked so much about, you know, narcissism and what a psychiatrist looks for when he's talking to somebody whose mental health is really seriously compromised. And we're going to go into that more today because we got a lot of feedback. And we also want to hear from you today. We're going to be taking calls probably middle of the show. But we have a lot of information to give you today. So it's an exciting day. This is a tangible, concrete problem in our society. We are not a political show. We do not try to take a political stance on things. We are observers who notice pathologies in our society. And we try to provide you experts and professionals who can shed a light on what might be going on. Not necessarily absolutely is going on, but what might be going on. And that's what we did yesterday, and we're going to follow that up today because we think, hey, this is very important information. Where on the dial, where in the media are you going to get an hour-long conversation with a psychiatrist talking about the symptoms of mental illness, the symptoms of a mass shooter, the symptoms of a violent person, and frankly, some diagnoses that you are always curious about and you want more information about, but you're never really exposed to. So we're going to be doing that with you today. We also have a first-time visitor to our studio, Justin Silk, who is an intern here at the Positive Mind Center and did a lot of research for us on this topic of mass shootings. Hey, Justin, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Hi, how's it going?
It's very good. Glad to have you aboard. So, you know, today, throughout our country, a lot of kids walked out of class today en masse, and the teachers were behind them, not in front of them. And the kids leading the way out the door to honor the 17 kids that were killed last month today. And, you know, a lot of people, no matter what side you are on, are respecting kids at this early age taking a very strong stance on something. They might very well have a very big impact in our culture going forward. So it's been a tragedy what's happened, but, you know, kids are probably in this generation more politically aware and have access to more political information than any generation before. So our democracy is really becoming a democracy from early age up. So we wanted to talk a little bit about that today. But let's talk first about what we talked about yesterday. Kent, you gave us an idea of what a psychiatrist looks for when he is sitting in the room after the kid or person is arrested an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours later, is sitting with a psychiatrist, and what a psychiatrist looks for. Could you start out today just reminding people what it is you ask and what you're looking for?
Well, again, whenever you're evaluating somebody who had committed some kind of crime or some kind of violent behavior, you know, you have to figure out whether this person has some kind of psychiatric problem that would mean that they would not be able to understand the actions that they're doing, that in some ways they're not responsible for their actions and the like. So, you know, one of the first things we're doing is asking questions to sort of see if the person is psychotic, which really means their mind is playing tricks on them and they're not in touch with reality. The truth is that many of these shooters and many people in prisons and many people who commit crimes of murder are not psychotic, right? There is not any sort of delusional belief system that God is telling them to do this or that Martians are, you know, influencing them and they need to clear out people because the Martian invasion will happen, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That these are people that have some kind of chronic sort of behavior in their psychology and in their brain where they have difficulties with relationships, difficulties with their self-esteem and their sense of self, and they have difficulties with basic morality, of ethics, of treating people well and treating people compassionately. And those kinds of questions that come into play have to do with asking people if they have a narcissistic kind of personality structure, meaning we ask questions that are often, you know, leading to whether this person has the kind of personality that often goes along with criminal behavior, which is both narcissistic personality and a narcissistic personality with a kind of cruel or mean or more corrupt kind of morality is often seen as an antisocial psychopathic personality.
And we should tell people that there are many different types of personalities. I mean, in the DSM, there are 10, right? Or is it 12?
Yeah. All the, you know, from somebody who's very obsessive compulsive could have a personality. You know, someone who's very rigid, very uptight, very moralistic, on, you know, can have a personality, and they'd be a very good accountant. Not to say anything about my accountant doing my taxes. I hope I didn't offend you or anybody at the IRS for that matter. But, you know, again, quite the opposite of a killer or a school shooter, somebody who's too uptight, too tightly wound, overly moralistic, you know, overly sense of right and wrong. So there's all sorts of personality. But the personality that we sometimes look for is narcissism. And there's certain questions that we ask about that.
Yeah, yeah. Why don't you say that? Because I just did want to say, you know, some people, a lot of people know like paranoid personalities or schizotypal or borderline personalities or avoidant personalities, personalities that will avoid people in general. These people have pathologies with other people also. But you're not looking for that when you're doing a mental health intake with a mass shooter. I mean, typically your mass shooter is not a borderline personality.
Right.
It's a narcissist. It's a definite, tangible set of symptoms that go down consistently on the narcissistic spectrum.
So. Right. A lot of people, and again, a lot of people, obviously, we talk a lot about self and self-esteem, and lots of people with low self-esteem, they don't have a narcissistic personality. They're kind of depressed, feel lesser than, they're apologizing and always feel guilty and the like. When we're talking, you know, lots of people with narcissism have low self-esteem, but really what they have is this structure, this layer of a compensatory, you know, this overly cocky, confident, arrogant personality that we feel often covers up the insecurities and the low self-esteem beneath it. But on the surface, the person comes across as very braggy and arrogant.
Kent, I'm wondering, because I think part of the thing that's so fascinating and terrifying about these kind of events and any kind of events where we see humans being atrocious, really, is that we want to separate ourselves from that. We say, wow, that's a monster, because it makes us feel better, because we don't want to imagine that a human could be capable of that, right? And I think that many of us have felt low self-esteem. Many of us have felt anger, maybe even rage. But what is it that, how do you separate that? How do you define where it takes it to the next level of sociopathy or,
pathology,
what you were saying earlier? I mean, how do we really draw that distinction?
Well, I think it's, you know, when right, all the traits that maybe I'm going to go over right now that a lot of you in, may listen to and say, oh, my God, I don't like to criticize. I don't like to be criticized. I mean, I get hurt when I'm criticized. And, oh, sometimes I feel kind of arrogant that I'm special or better than other people. And sometimes my self-esteem goes through ups and downs. So I think it's absolutely true and very much you know, being empathic and care and sympathetic, that narcissistic personality structure is on a spectrum where we all have some of these traits, and even a healthy narcissism, a healthy sense of self-respect and a little bit of, you know, sort of feeling good about ourselves and being optimistic and feeling like we could put our mind to anything and get things done is a positive thing that's seen in a lot of leaders and successful people. It's when this is on steroids, right? When the whole basis mm-hmm. of this person's life seems to be all about getting praise, admiration from other people, that's their whole life is one of bragging, of one of arrogance, of one of feeling special. It's not every once in a while, it's all the time. And it's really the basis that they have interactions with other people that often isn't winning friends and influencing people. But because they're so wrapped up in their need for praise and their need to feel successful, that's not even that important. You know, that relationships are often just about having people admire me or praise me. Mm. Not necessarily to love and care about me, but I want people to think I'm great, that I'm spectacular,
yeah.
that I'm special.
And so a lot of narcissists important. Will talk about what I'm going to do. I'm going to one day. I'm going to be great. And these are red flags. Like when the kids are putting out on the internet, I'm going to go do such and such a great thing and I'll be very famous because of it. I mean, they're broadcasting this steroid that you're talking about, this condition on steroids.
Right.
So why don't you run through some of the narcissistic questions that sure. would illustrate narcissism?
Sure. And I would say that my children who are under 10 years old, they all have this. And Kent Robertshaw and Kevin. And I mean, there's something about this part of feeling unlimited amount of success in the future. I could put my mind. All I know is if I ask a 7-year-old, you know, what do they want to do when they grow up? It's nothing mundane. It's something spectacular. I want to be a rock star. Or I want to be an NBA basketball player. Or I want to be the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard and blah, 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 blah. And then reality rears its ugly head and we're all forced to sort of be more humble or have different ethics or different values than just being special and being valedictorian and homecoming queen and the like, as well as we often find it's not very good to be getting along with others, that nobody likes a blowhard. Nobody likes someone who's bragging. In fact, it invites people to want to stick a pin in that balloon of yours to bring you back down to earth. It doesn't make people feel good to have a friend that's always arrogant and bragging.
But you give a great example. I mean, it illustrates the point that when little kids are doing that, it really speaks to a need, you know. I need to be important when I get older. You know, I think that's what narcissism is at the root of narcissism. There is a sense of I am not worthy or I'm not well, or, you know, I don't have a lot of self-worth. And if I do something big, if I become like the chairman of the board, if I become this huge success, then it will fill that hole. So narcissism is really born out of some internal need, whether it's grandiose, whether it's mature, you know, whether it's healthy narcissism or, in this case, really unhealthy narcissism, right? I mean, do you see it born out of some kind of, like you say, compensatory need?
Yeah, I mean, and I think a lot of people are successful narcissists in the sense that they are spectacularly, you know, achieve greatness and they're running companies and they're very powerful people. They don't necessarily come to treatment, except that, as I mentioned yesterday, sometimes, again, friends and family couldn't care less about your achievements or whatever. We had enough of it, and you're not a very nice person. You're important, but you're not very nice. You're not very compassionate. You're not very giving. You're not very altruistic. And that gets in the way of a lot of relationships. But the school shooters are, like many people out there that we treat, Kevin, are what we call failed narcissists, meaning that they're finding out at 15, 25, 20, 35 years old that they're not reaching their grandiose goals and expectations.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue, our guests today. Dr. Kent Robertshaw back with us, always a pleasure. And Justin Silk, an intern and mental health student here at the Positive Mind Center. Great to have you both here. I just want to ask really quickly, Kent, what do you make of people who say there's like this causal link between violent movies or violent video games and then the violent acts? Do you see there that being a causal link there or not?
I think so far there hasn't been a one-to-one link for sure. There hasn't been any studies that would support that. But, you know, there's some part of me at a knee-jerk level that says it can't be good to have a young mind, you know, absorbed with violence and aggression. And I think video games also vary, as I watch my son play video games, between, you know, shoot 'em up cowboys of like 1940s or even, you know, Hamlet or something. There's always like entertainment of people killing each other, like Shakespeare and obviously movies 50, 60 years ago. There would be, you know, James Cagney would shoot the bad guy and John Wayne would shoot the Indian or something like that. And then there's stuff that's much more gratuitously gruesome, where there's like sadism and the like. And I can't help but think, at a spidey sense, that can't be good. Movies and video games that really get into just enjoying, like the movie Saw or stuff like that, where it's just kind of where sadism comes in and maybe kind of fueled or encouraged in young minds. But I don't know. That's a spidey sense. No research, just my gut.
Go ahead, Justin.
I was going to say, in regards to video games, too, I also think there's a huge difference between, like, shooting an alien and shooting, like, a person. Like, if you're playing one of those army video games and you're gratuitously killing a ton of people, it's a lot different than if you're playing, like, something like Halo, where you're just shooting aliens all the time who are clearly not real things.
Right. And I guess it would be the more extreme it is. That's when I would be concerned. Now they've, you know, produced such games where it's so extreme. And they're actually having blood, you know, they're having these illustrations. But to me, it would be more, it's a great question, Ben, but, you know, to me, it would be more, what is deprivation? You know, what is this filling? What is these video games filling in this young kid? Is it healthy filling or is it, you know, pathological filling? Does this kid have an emptiness that is chronic that needs this kind of stimulation? Or is this just one of the things the kid uses to fill himself?
Yeah, and, you know, healthier ways of dealing with boredom or a sense of too much time, because, again, part of the irony of 2018 is that we have too much time on our hands, right? That people, again, theorized 100, 200 years ago when your day was structured all day and you had a place to go and things to do all day, you were in somewhat happier than having all this free time that we have, and people don't know what to do with this free time and go on to addictions and go on to food and pornography and shopping and all the like as a way to fill up a hole that's now there as a product of how we live in a mechanical society where people don't work nearly as hard as hundreds of years ago, where they'd have to wash their own clothes and walk to the town rather than take a car, et cetera, et cetera.
I think you make a great point that movies and even literature have had violence in them as long as there have been movies and literature. Right. And I think that's a good point. Mm-hmm. And when I think about the trends that we've seen in the last 20 years or so, I mean, the video game industry has taken off while violent crime overall has come down. And I can't help but think that it's like you said, with all this free time,
except
right?
mass violent crime and hasn't gone down.
Yeah.
Mass shootings have gone up.
Right.
You know,
so violent crime overall, violent crime has come down significantly since the late 80s, early 90s.
Sure.
And that's nationwide.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think that there has to be something to do with the alienation that happens with the proliferation of social media and everyone's online. Everyone's experiencing life through a screen. It's kind of the barrier between them and real human connection. That's my gut feeling, but again, I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the ideas, as you said, Ben, violent crime is actually down over the last 20, 30 years in terms of homicides and the like. But as Kevin says, these kind of mass murders, these school shootings, the church shootings, these, you know, happening at Las Vegas a couple of months ago, whatever, these kind of group shootings, you know, like commando-esque, meaning that somebody seems to have some vengeance that's going on. They get in military gear, they get their guns together, and they seem like Rambo, as we talked about in First Blood. I've been shamed, humiliated, I feel lesser than, and I almost feel justified to now retaliate the shame and humiliation that I went through. That's probably been true for hundreds of years, that feeling. What I suspect in the last 20 years of why school shootings and the like are up is because, again, this is where people can satisfy their narcissistic need of 15 minutes of shame, even 15 minutes of fame.
It's a lifetime of shame.
Undone by 15 minutes of notoriety.
Yeah.
That may be a clue that we're in a culture that is, again, obsessed with you know, Paris Hilton and Donald Trump and Brad Pitt and celebrity and fame and celebrity and fame and power, and have lost a little bit of our values in that way. And that can fuel somebody who feels lesser than and alienated and insecure and feels like they're going to be a big nothing and never get to their grandiose feelings of who they are, that at least if I do this, which is often a suicidal act as well, because most often they die in these shootings. This Cruz is an exception. It's a murder-suicide. They're going to go out in a blaze of worldwide recognition.
Yeah. In the second half of the show, I'm going to ask you about the chemistry, because the switch seems to go off where this some things get bypassed, like with healthy narcissism and unhealthy narcissism. There is a container. For healthy narcissists, there's a way to prevent these, you know, gross behaviors. But something in unhealthy narcissism bypasses the usual mechanisms of constraint. And that I'm going to ask you about in the second half. I did want to ask Justin about particular examples. Let's talk about this emptiness before we go into the questions a psychiatrist asks to diagnose narcissism. Because yesterday we talked about an MRI that would show a lot of the brain chemistry that seems to be missing with these mass shooters. And so we thought these questions on narcissism would be helpful. But if the basic premise is emptiness and then you know, solution to the emptiness with a kind of grandiosity, shouldn't we be looking at what is causing the emptiness in these young people? So Justin did some research for us. Tell me, Justin, about Nicholas. Wasn't he bought for a price?
So from how I understand it after doing a ton of research, he was, I guess, bought from his biological mother for like $50,000. And his younger brother was bought while his biological mother was still pregnant with the younger brother. And the younger brother was bought for 15, not 50. But basically, his adoptive parents were getting older and they were having trouble adopting. So they purchased both boys. And, you know, it just – the adoptive parents had interesting relationships with both of the boys. The adopted father died of a heart attack when Nicholas was, like, 5 years old. And I guess Nicholas witnessed that death.
So he was exposed to death at a very young age.
Yeah.
Of an important figure in his life.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
And then he seemed also – and it seemed like he was close with his biological mother, but she passed away shortly before the shooting. And, you know, it seems like it spiraled from there. But, I mean, Nicholas had various different issues from a very young age.
He received mental health treatment. He agreed to it through his high school years, even though he was expelled, right? He also was taking psychotropic meds, and he was compliant, except when he turned 18, he was also put into special ed classes, and he felt shamed and insulted by that. He didn't think that he belonged in those classes, but he, you know, he continued to go to school, but something got him kicked out of school. We don't have to talk about that, but the important thing was that he was compliant. But after 18, he refused any kind of mental health services.
Yeah, he refused health services when he turned 18. For many years, he went to an alternative school for disabled children and for children who have emotional issues. And he requested, actually, to be reintegrated back into his public school.
And he was.
Right. And he was, and then I guess they told him after the full reintegration had occurred that he was still acting out and that alternative school was his only remaining option.
Mm-hmm.
So he was forced into this environment that he felt was hindering him developmentally. I can only imagine what that does to your psyche.
Yeah, so you first of all, you're bought for a price, and then you're rejected at school and put into classes that you don't feel like you belong in.
With children who could be extremely disabled and, you know,
who's so autism kids or different types of kids that were not on the same psychological or mental.
Yeah, and who he couldn't feel like he could relate to. So I just can't imagine. Okay.
Kent, do you want to talk a little bit about that before we go to the break?
I just want to say, I understand the guy went through a lot of these hardships, but mm-hmm. I know lots of people who have been through extremely challenging trials and tribulations of life, and they didn't take this action.
I
so,
agree.
Again, I'm wondering, sure. What is it? Because many, many people out there mm-hmm. are going through it. Many people out there are struggling with immense challenges, family challenges, professional, academic. What is it?
Emptiness.
What is it, though, that pushes someone to do that? Because it's still all the personal trials and tribulations to me aren't exactly enough explanation. It's still hard for me to wrap my head around.
Right, I hear you. Yesterday we talked about, that experiment that they did with handling a gun, like what that does to testosterone level. And the those that were given mouse traps to handle and set up, as opposed to the guns, didn't have as much of a raise in vindictiveness, let's call it, because those who actually got their hands on a gun, their testosterone level went up to such a degree that they added so much hot sauce to a glass of water, and they really felt fury when they were told that the water was not going to be delivered to a person. So, I don't know what it is, Ben. I think you raise a very, very good question. But, Kent, is emptiness at the base of it? Let's do these narcissism questions. Yeah. Is an emptiness, an inner emptiness, at the root of this?
Yeah, I think that the kind of questions we ask about, getting to some of the ideas of narcissism is whether the person has a sense of self-importance, a grandiose and exaggerated sense. And we'll ask them, do you describe yourself as somebody who will accomplish great things and has all your accomplishments set you apart from other people? It's another category of narcissism is preoccupied with unlimited success and power. And
so I'm not just going to be great. I'm going to be the greatest.
Right. And this would be, again, a lot of time. Questions, do you spend a lot of time daydreaming about your future, about being powerful, about being brilliant, about being, successful? And do your daydreams get in the way of you actually functioning? Do you spend a lot of time not, as we would say, dreaming of castles in the sky, but living in them, just sort of thinking about how you're going to have all these models and Lamborghinis and running companies and private jets and all
that? So I would think that there's an art to asking these questions because a very savvy interviewee is going to see through, the pathologizing of the questions. But you could say, how important is your daydreaming life to you?
Right.
How important are fantasies to you? What kind of fantasies do you have? We all have fantasies. I have fantasies,
Right.
So, these are the clinical questions, but obviously when you do them, do you use the kind of awareness of who you're asking these questions to?
Well, I think that a lot of people, as we said yesterday, a lot of people with narcissistic personality, a lot of people with sociopathic personality, they assume everybody's like them, right? So, again, it comes as a shock to a lot of my clients that once they're in therapy that have narcissistic or sociopathic tendencies that not everybody is as obsessed with beauty and power and perfection and being important and money here in New York City, obviously, obsessed with money and making money and how that makes you feel powerful and the like, that not everyone is like that, let alone, again, more sociopathic questions that people don't want to always trick people, and always everybody always has an ulterior motivation. Of course, most of the patients who come to us, Kevin, they or narcissistic or sociopathic, they're like, you're in this profession to make money and to rip off the insurance company or to brainwash me or something like that.
Right?
Like they just can't imagine that we're here partly we have a living to do, but we actually care about and concerned and empathic and have compassion for them. That's really shocking to them that people are like that.
Kent, we want to take calls in the second half, and we will put something out there about these narcissistic qualities, asking if you are surrounded by a narcissist. So we're going to give you these questions, and then you can ask, and then you can give us a call at 516-757-5555. But wait for our questions. We're about to take a musical break.
Sounds of Kenny Burrell here on WBAI. You're tuned into The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue. Our guests today, we have Dr. Kent Robertshaw back with us, and a new guest here, first-time guest Justin Silk. Welcome back, or welcome for the first time, to both of you.
Thanks.
So, Kent, we're going to take calls, 212-757-5555. We're going to finish with the kinds of questions a psychiatrist asks to determine whether a person has narcissism, a personality disorder. So, Kent, you ask the first one. Go ahead.
Yeah, the first one, another question. Do you think you're special and unique and can only be understood by a certain amount of people? You know, that, again, that you don't get along with others because you're so special and unique that that's a problem that you have. And
so would people say that you think you're unique? If people in your environment are saying to you, you know, you think you're so special or you think you're unique, you know, I think that's another way to ask that same question. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm just hung up a little bit on how we're asking these questions to people and whether we're going to get an accurate answer. I mean, obviously, that's sometimes an issue in a psychiatric interview that you're not always going to get the truth, right?
Right, right. Because I don't think these people are covering up so much.
I mean, they feel honored to be interviewed.
Do you consider yourself particularly special or a unique person would be a kind of question.
Okay. Yeah.
Is it hard for others to understand you? I think a lot of people would feel like, yes. I mean, isn't it self-evident that I'm, you know, who I am? Can't you tell that I'm better than everybody else? Obviously, this next part about requires excessive admiration is a big part of narcissism, you know. Praise and admiration from friends and colleagues is so important to you. And has anyone ever accused you of fishing for compliments? Obviously, this would be along with bragging as well as something that people would do. Now, this next thing about a special entitlement is a very important thing because I think a lot of people feel like they need special consideration, you know, that because of their sense of importance. So that would be a question. Like, do you feel like, you know, that you should get special treatment or be treated differently because your unique talents and the like?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just as an aside, Nietzsche, right, the great philosopher, talked about Übermensch, right? The Übermensch, mensch being
Superman.
Person. Superman.
Yep.
The Superman was the superior person, and obviously didn't end well with Nazism and the like. But that core belief that Nietzsche talked about, which is special people get special rules, right? They get to not act like everyone else, is really at the heart of this sort of question. Not a very empathic, spiritual concept of life. And a lot of people feel, again, that it's true in our society, that people get off for murder and whatever like that. There's a core belief. But obviously, these people feel that I don't have to live by ordinary rules because I'm a demigod, because I'm superior.
Sure.
So, other people have to wait in line. I can butt in line. Other people have to pay their taxes. I shouldn't have to pay my taxes.
Is there a question in there about empathy? Because clearly, one of the hallmarks of narcissism is an inability to sense what other people are feeling. I know what I'm feeling, but I don't care about what anybody else is feeling.
Yeah, just a basic lack of empathy is very big part of it. And I've certainly, Kevin, as a therapist over the time, I've had people come in, and it's like I'm in a room full of like a narcissist, like a garden variety narcissist, not a killer narcissist, would be watching the news report of this Florida killing a month ago and watch people tearing up on the television and seeing maybe people in their room tearing up, or say that my girlfriend or boyfriend or somebody's tearing up around me. And yet they're pretty unempathic, for example, about watching the news and don't really, they can understand and analyze the emotions, but they're not compassionate. That's the key difference. They're not really feeling what other people are feeling. They don't have that emotional empathy. As we talked about yesterday, often they're very slick and manipulative and know about other people's feelings in order to exploit them at a cognitive level, at a brain level, but not at a visceral emotional level. They just really don't care that much about other people. You know, the fact that you're 10 minutes late to my session, the narcissistic therapist makes me very angry. The fact that you almost broke your leg and the subway was held up or something like that is immaterial to the fact that I'm upset that you're 10 minutes late and I couldn't really care that much that you just went through heck.
Yeah. So there are signals everybody is exposed to that could maybe suggest some lack of empathy that everybody could register. But there are places where it's really, really pathological. So we're asking 212-757. We still have a few more. 212-757-5555. Tell us about the narcissist in your life. What is a good way to interview a narcissist? How can we unearth these kinds of qualities in narcissists?
I think yesterday we talked about, you know, mothers and parents who One of the things that they do to not sort of help their child and sort of go along, and to use the addiction word, enable their child to have these narcissistic and sociopathic traits. And over the 30 years as a therapist, I certainly see many person that has a child, a son or daughter, that's alienated and not fitting in, and the child comes home and says that people don't like me because I'm better than them or whatever, and the parents co-sign that. The parents then will collude with them and say, you're right, everyone's envious of you, that's why they won't want to be your friends. And as a therapist, I'd be like, well, it seems like the valedictorian and the homecoming queen and the captain of the football team has lots of friends, right? So I don't get it if it's so true that people don't want to be friends because of envy. But you can see both sometimes people's own belief system, which is the reason people don't like me is not because I'm an arrogant braggart who doesn't care about other people. No, that's not what I have that realization of. Uh-huh. It's because people are envious of me.
Right.
That's why they're not friends with me, you know, and complete denial about how this behavior, this personality is kind of off-putting and not really making people want to connect with them.
So that kid is definitely not Irish. No Irish kid would go home and tell his parents how great he is.
Right.
So certain ethnic backgrounds might be exempt from narcissism. We have other problems,
right,
but narcissism isn't one of them. Anyway, a few more. Is there a few more questions?
Yeah, I think the last one, again, is being arrogant and haughty. You know, has anyone ever told you you have a chip on your shoulder? Has anyone ever told you you act in an arrogant manner, you know, and a haughty manner, acting in a way that makes you feel like you're better than other people. And just as a little aside for 15 seconds, I will say, as a therapist, I have treated people who are phenomenally successful and CEOs and Academy Award winners and whatever, and they are sometimes incredibly nice to everybody. It's true.
Yeah.
And then I've seen a lot of posers, a lot of, you know, people who aren't that special and on all that and a bag of chips. And boy, do they treat people around them in a disgruntled, sort of despicable way of like, I'm better than them and everyone around me is stupid and ignorant and they don't dress well and they're not pretty and they're not smart and they're not as great as I am.
Yeah.
So there's no correlation between real success and how people have a psychological ability to treat people as equals and important.
I mean, it becomes so obvious when you're making grandiose claims about how great you are, and then your job is like, you know, you're collecting money at a toll booth or something. Right. I mean, it becomes so the disparity between what you think you are and what you are doing and spending most of your time doing, is a great indicator of unhealthy narcissism. And as you say, narcissism is steroids on steroids, is when we reach these unhealthy people. Justin, tell us a little bit about Adam Lanza. What was the kind of deprivation he was exposed to? Because I know that
the Sandy Hook help.
The Sandy Hook, because he was anorexic, wasn't he? Or what did he suffer from?
Yeah, so Lanza was very anorexic. He was 6 feet tall and he weighed 112 pounds. He also it's said that he also had OCD and high anxiety. But Lanza was interesting because he really didn't receive any like mental health services. At least he denied a lot of them. And he denied a lot of the help that he was offered.
And his mother approved that. Or, you know,
yeah, and his mother fully endorsed it. It's kind of conflicted about which medications he was taking. But I guess his mother, he was given Celexa, and his mother told the doctor that she didn't want him taking it anymore after he complained that he couldn't lift one of his arms while on the drug. Which the doctor, I suppose, thought was, like, not Kent, related.
Would Celexa help with violent tendencies?
Why I've been a part of this show as a firebrand psychiatrist and not a stooge of Big Pharma.
You have been, for sure.
Meaning, you know, we wish there were, you know, like Cher used to say in that commercial, if a pill got you a body like this, everyone would have a body, right? That famous commercial, right? You have to do. And similarly, medication is not the treatment for many, many people's problems in life, right, including mass killers. Most of these people don't have a psychotic episode that is fueling this. So medication is not the answer. It's really ongoing therapy other kinds of treatments. And that's true for many of the listening audience. It's Brave New World to think a pill is going to fix chronic software in your brain.
We have a call.
Yeah, let's take a quick call. Yvette's on the line. Hi.
Yes, hi.
Hello, Yvette.
Hi. Wow, this program is just amazing. I've never heard anything like it, and I'm so glad to be listening at this time
Thank you. Good to respond.
Yeah. I guess first thing, just a lot of times when we hear about these mass killings and what's happening, and I don't mean to take the emphasis off of the victims, but the perpetrators are all defined as a man, like this man, and then they're not men, you know, they're young boys, 18, 19, that have these mental issues, and we don't get kind of the background on the news of what's happening in their life. So in this program, you talked about Nicholas, his background and what he was experiencing, and a lot of people don't hear that, and so they have no empathy or passion because it's just like this man. Mm-hmm. So
this monster.
To give that, it was just amazing. This is a problem we have to fix, and it has to be inclusive. We have to understand the problems that people are encountering so that we can come up with something to help each other because it affects all of us.
Yes, I totally get what you're saying. And I'm wondering, Kent, like, can we teach empathy? I mean, should schools be teaching empathy, this very quality that narcissists are unable to have? And she's talking about younger people. But it's got to be hard, Yvette, if you've been suffering your whole life, if you've been on some level feeling deprived or mistreated or even worse, abused, to be empathic for other people. But it's a really, really good question. I mean, the Las Vegas shooter obviously was 60 years old. So, you know, he obviously had a defect in empathy going on also. But talk a little bit, Kent, about the empathy failure in younger people.
Well, again, I think Yvette is saying also not this that these people who end up in jail or committing these crimes have empathy failure, but we, the public, sit at home and see these people as monsters. And if we walked in the moccasins, not to, again, justify and say it's okay and to blame society and mommy and daddy for what went down of why they committed these crimes, but it is true that many people with violent criminal behavior, if we walked a mile in their moccasins about their childhoods of adoption and abuse and substance abuse and sexual abuse and being hit and all sorts of things, we wouldn't distance ourselves as us and them so much and see that we're all connected and they had some stuff going down that really warped their capacity to feel good about themselves and to feel love, which is what it's all about, you know?
Yvette, are you still there?
I am still there, and I'm so glad that we talked about connections. And listening to WBAI, I'm a faithful listener. There was
Johari.
He has a book out
Lost Connections.
Connections, during the fund drive, I have ordered, and I am waiting to read this book because I think it's going to go to social values, talks about anxiety, depression, and what we can do to help each other to get that connection back, that, again, being inclusive and not, it's not us and them, and this will solve a lot of issues that we're dealing with. It's so important.
Totally agree with you, Yvette. We're going to try and get him on the air on our show. So thanks for listening today. Yeah, we're gonna get him.
Much.
Thanks for listening.
This is an amazing program. Thank you. Loving everything.
All right.
Please keep it going.
You bet. Have a good day.
All right. You too.
Be well.
Thanks, Yvette. 212-757-5555 is the number to call.
Is there anything more you want to add on Adam Lanza? He did not take his meds.
So he
got off whatever he was taking.
Yeah, he got off whatever he was taking, which again,
Lexapro and then Celexa.
Yeah, there's conflicting reports on what he was actually taking. But Lanza, he wasn't receiving the help that he needed. I guess he was going online, and talking on message boards and fantasizing about mass murder. No one's shut those sites down.
Right.
He wasn't getting attention.
Okay.
Even
Cruz was, he was on the FBI list, but 6 weeks before the shooting, he was taken off the list.
Yeah, I think that it's a needle in the haystack. I think for every person that commits this act, I don't feel, and this is, I guess, what they're talking about policy-wise of screening, mental health, I would assume there's tens of thousands, if not more, adolescents that are twisted up inside, that are alienated, that have fantasies about shooting people that have wronged them and the like. And the question as a society, do we round them all up, and screen them and take them off the streets? Because I think it's going to be a needle in the haystack to try to identify in retrospect who's the person who's going to not just fantasize and have all these personality traits, but who's going to act on it.
We have time for one more caller. We have Sandra on the line. Hi, thanks for calling in.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, Sandra.
Hi. Yeah, my comment is twofold. One, that commentator, you guys, whoever you're interviewing at this time, if you're honest with yourself, I think that any person, anybody, you, me included, if we're subjected to being in an emotional state, and at any given moment without any kind of support system or any support at the time, we're liable to conduct any mass crime or horrible murder or, if the opportunity presented itself because we're in an emotional state. So I just want to kind of like not minimize anything, but, state the fact. I think that's a fact, number one. Number two, that I let the young lady know that I also was diagnosed with a severe mental disorder, which was called bipolar 1, years ago, and was put on heavy medications and felt like a zombie. And 25 years later, I have a new psychiatric diagnosis of bipolar 1 in remission for many years now, and I haven't been on medication because I kept saying I don't want this medication. And I agree with long-term therapy. And even things like meditation and yoga, mindfulness, CBT, different talk therapies and cognitive therapies that help a person have the ability to reframe and rethink or at least pause and think before acting.
Beautiful.
But, but truth be told, we're all liable to such an act.
Yeah.
I mean, when we had the opportunity or if we took the steps that these men, young men, children, people take, and the ones that we don't listen to every day, the girlfriends that get shot by the boyfriends, because they lied about being pregnant or whatever. And these are kids killing each other.
I'm going to have Dr. Kent Robichaud respond to you. Congratulations on your journey and your awareness. And thanks for your insight, Kent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the it goes without saying, I guess, we're talking about not wartime, right? I mean, she's talking about anybody can have these acts and be callous and be whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just very interesting. All this is, I don't want to get political here, but it does seem that during wartime, Iraq war, a million Iraqis died, and the United States was responsible for, two atomic bombs that killed 80,000 and 60,000 people. There's a weird thing that happens to our morality and ethics and the like during wartime that we're all capable of going along with.
I totally agree. We should do a show on optimal parenting. What is it that these kids are missing? in the early stages. Yes, she has a point that anybody is susceptible to wild behaviors when they're in an emotional state. But good parenting helps children control their emotions or experience their emotions. We talked yesterday about frustrated needs of young people.
Yeah, and I think, again, you were asking yesterday and in general, I think the mantra I have with treating adolescents that are violent and adult prisoners and the like is that bad is connected to mad, and mad is connected to sad, right? And many of these people's lives are filled with abandonment and abuse and the like, and that the therapy gets to trying to unveil their bad behavior is reflecting their mad, and their mad is coming up, they're sad.
Mad, bad, sad, glad, and one other. Okay.
Dr. Kent Robertshaw, thank you so much for being back with us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Justin Silk, thank you for coming, and thanks for your research. We wanted to say happy birthday.
Okay.
To an old friend of ours, Mr. Armand DeMille. It's Pi Day today, so let's go out with a tune Armand used to love. Can you tune one of those up?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, if we don't have Happy Birthday, maybe we can go out with some Ben Webster or Coltrane.
Absolutely. Well, thanks
happy birthday, Armand. We miss you very much.
Thanks everyone out there for tuning in, and we'll be back next week, Tuesday at 1 p.m. Take care. Mm-hmm.